Welcome back to the deep dive. We usually start these conversations by looking at a threat, right?
Right.
And usually when the topic is quantum computing, that threat is pretty obvious. It's the Q-Day scenario.
Oh yeah, the machine that breaks all encryption.
Exactly. Steals the nuclear codes, drains your bank account before you can even finish your morning coffee.
The ultimate thief. And to be fair, that was the focus of class two in the course we've been looking at, the whole confidentiality risk.
Right, the fear that the machine knows things it shouldn't. But looking at the research for today, specifically class three of the quantum law course, that whole story gets flipped on its head.
Completely.
Today, the quantum computer isn't the defendant, it isn't the thief. It's the star witness. And honestly, after reading this, I think having a quantum computer help you in court might be more of a headache than having one hack you.
It's certainly a bigger philosophical headache.
Mm.
We're moving from confidentiality risk to what the course creator, Ralph Losey, calls epistemic risk.
Epistemic risk. Now, I know what you're thinking. And yes, that sounds like a term that belongs in a dusty philosophy seminar, not a high-stakes litigation firm.
It sounds abstract, but it's actually the most practical problem a lawyer can face. I mean, epistemology is the study of knowledge, how we know what we know.
So epistemic risk is?
It's asking a very simple, very terrifying question. How do we trust what this machine is telling us? Because, as we're about to see, the way a quantum computer thinks is fundamentally incompatible with how the legal system thinks.
That's the central conflict here. The sources paint this picture of a collision between two universes. You have the legal universe and you have the quantum universe.
And they do not speak the same language. They operate on entirely different physics.
Let's drill into that. When I think of the legal system, I don't usually think of physics. But the argument here is that the law assumes a clockwork universe.
It really does. It's built on Isaac Newton.
Mm-hmm.
Determinism. Think about a calculator. You type in 2,456 divided by 12, you get a number.
And you get the same number every time.
The exact same number. If you do it 1,000 times, it never changes. The law loves this. It treats evidence like a machine. Same input, same output.
Right. And if I'm a witness and I tell the police one story on Tuesday and a slightly different story on Friday,
you're unreliable. You're impeached. Consistency is the proxy for truth in the courtroom. If the gears turn the same way, the machine is working. If the results vary,
the machine or the witness is broken.
But quantum computers don't play by Newton's rules. They play by Heisenberg's.
Meaning they're probabilistic.
Exactly. If you ask a quantum computer a complex simulation question, say, asking it to simulate a chemical reaction for a patent case, it doesn't give you a single hard number. It gives you a distribution. A landscape of probabilities.
And if you ask it again?
The landscape might shift slightly.
So if I put this machine on the stand, metaphorically speaking, and cross-examine it, it's never going to give me the exact same answer twice.
Correct. And under current legal standards, a good defense attorney would tear that apart. They'd scream, unreliable. And the judge, relying on centuries of precedent, might just agree.
So our mission in this deep dive is to figure out how to stop that from happening, to explore class three of the course and figure out how to update the legal operating system to handle a witness that tells the truth through probability.
And to do that, we have to go back to the maze.
The maze. We touched on this in the first session, but I think we need to upgrade the analogy for the courtroom. It really helped me visualize why this evidence is so weird.
It's the best way to understand the underlying mechanics. So imagine a classical computer, your laptop, as a mouse in a giant complex maze.
Okay.
It's looking for the exit, which is the solution. The mouse is fast. It runs down one path, hits a wall, marks it, goes back, tries another path.
So trial and error, brute force.
But crucially, it traces a single line. If you put the mouse back at the start, it will run that exact same path again. It's traceable, reproducible.
Now swap the mouse for the quantum computer.
The quantum computer isn't a mouse. It's water. You pour water into the entrance of the maze. The water doesn't choose a path. It floods all the paths simultaneously.
Superposition.
Exactly. It finds the exit not by tracing a line, but by interacting with the geometry of the maze itself.
Okay, sticking with the water analogy, this is where the legal trouble starts. Because eventually, you have to measure the water. You have to get an answer.
Right. You have to sort of freeze the water. And this is where the terminology from the course gets really important. Quantum output isn't a single result. It comes in shots and runs.
Okay, break those down. What's a shot?
A shot is a single execution of the quantum circuit. It's like taking one photograph of that splashing water. Because of quantum mechanics, One shot might show the water slightly more to the left, the next shot slightly to the right. A single shot is basically useless. It's noise.
So you can't just run the program once?
Never. You have to aggregate thousands of shots. That's called a run. You stack all those photos on top of each other until a pattern merges. You get a bell curve.
And that bell curve is the evidence.
That's the key takeaway. You don't hand the judge a number, you hand the judge a probability distribution. You say, Your Honor, the answer is most likely here, in the center of this curve.
I can already hear the objection. Objection, Your Honor. The prosecution admits that if they ran this test again, the curve would look different.
And they'd be right. The curve would look slightly different. The peak might shift a tiny bit. The edges might fuzz out differently because of thermal noise.
To a jury raised on CSI where the fingerprint matches 100% or it doesn't match at all, that just sounds like reasonable doubt.
It sounds like the machine is guessing. Which brings us to the core legal concept of Class 3. We have to shift the standard of evidence. We have to move from demanding identity to accepting fidelity.
Identity versus fidelity. This feels like the big conceptual anchor of this whole deep dive. So what's the old way? What is identity in a legal sense?
Identity is what we have now. You know, Federal Rule of Evidence 901, we want the copy to be identical to the original. The second test, identical to the first. If I calculate the trajectory of a bullet, the math should be identical every time.
It matches, or it doesn't. Binary.
Exactly. And fidelity, it's about faithfulness to the process. It acknowledges that there will be variation, but it asks, is the system behaving truthfully? The course material uses a great analogy here, the radar gun.
I liked this one. It makes sense. You're driving down the highway.
And you get clocked at 61 miles per hour.
Mm.
You argue, so the cop clocks you again 2 seconds later. Now it's at 63.
Okay, now technically those numbers are contradictory. I can't be going 61 and 63 at the same time.
Exactly. If we demanded identity, we'd have to throw out the ticket. The machine gave two different numbers. But we don't do that. We accept fidelity. We know radar guns have a margin of error. We accept that both numbers fall within a reliable range of truth.
So for the quantum computer, we aren't asking, did it give the exact same string of binary code? We're asking, does this result fall within the expected probability distribution?
Precisely. We are checking if the water flowed the way physics says it should flow, even if the splash marks are slightly different each time.
But how do you prove that to a skeptical judge? I mean, with a radar gun, we have decades of case law. With a quantum simulation and a patent dispute, it's brand new. You can't just say, trust the physics, Your Honor.
You need verification. And since you can't check the work with a classical computer, remember, the maze is too big for the mouse. You have to use the quantum computer to check itself.
This is the time reversal concept, right? The quantum echo.
That's the one. It's like running a movie backward.
Yeah.
You run the computation forward, scrambling the information. Then mathematically, you reverse the operation. If the system has perfect fidelity, it should return to the exact state it started in.
Like unmixing cream and coffee.
If you can do that, you've proven the machine is faithful. It won't be a perfect return. There's always some noise. But if it's close enough, you've proven fidelity.
Yeah.
You've proven the machine wasn't just hallucinating.
Okay, so we have a new standard, fidelity. But not all quantum evidence is created equal. If I'm a lawyer, I need to know when to accept the fidelity argument and when to fight it.
That's why the course provides the reliability ladder. It's a framework for lawyers to categorize exactly how trustworthy the evidence is. It has four rungs.
Let's climb it. Rung one.
Rung one is classical simulation. This is kind of a cheat. It's when you use a massive classical supercomputer to pretend to be a quantum computer.
The mouse trying to act like water.
A very, very fast mouse. But because it's classical, it's deterministic. Legally, this is the safest rung. It's just normal computer evidence. Treat it like any other expert model.
Boring. Let's get to the real stuff. Rung two, NESQ.
NESQ. It stands for Noisy Intermediate Scale Quantum. These are the machines we actually have today. They're powerful, but they're messy.
Messy how?
They're incredibly sensitive. Thermal noise, vibration, background radiation, even a cosmic ray hitting the processor can flip a qubit.
So if I'm the defense attorney and the other side brings in evidence from an NISQ machine, what's my attack plan?
You attack the noise, don't attack the math, attack the conditions. You ask, did you account for the thermal fluctuations on the specific day you ran this? What was your error mitigation set?
Sample size, I'm guessing.
Huge. If they only ran 50 shots on an NISQ machine, that's garbage. That's just reading the noise. You need thousands and thousands of shots.
Got it. Rung three. This seems to be the sweet spot.
Quantum native verified.
Yeah.
This is where they use those internal checks we talked about, like the Echo protocol. They admit the machine is noisy, but they have a mathematical proof that the signal is real.
So here, I can't attack the noises easily.
No. Here, you have to attack the methodology. Is the echo technique they use generally accepted? It becomes a battle of the experts.
And finally, rung 4, the oracle.
This is the danger zone. This is when a company comes in and says, here's the answer. Our machine is smarter than you. Trust us. No calibration logs, no error rates, just the result.
The black box.
Worse than a black box. It's a magic eight ball. If someone tries to introduce rung 4 evidence, it should be inadmissible. If you can't see the error bars, it's just a guess.
Speaking of black boxes, this triggers a huge part of the process, discovery. In a normal software case, if I think your program is faulty, I demand to see the source code.
And in the quantum world, looking under the hood is complicated. There are actually two types of black boxes here.
Okay.
The first is the one lawyers are used to, the legal black box.
Trade secrets. We can't show you our algorithm. It's proprietary.
And we know how to handle that. Protective orders, clean rooms, all that stuff.
Okay.
But the second one is the physical black box. This goes back to a core concept of quantum mechanics.
Mm.
If you measure a quantum state while it is calculating,
you collapse the wave function. You destroy the evidence by looking at it.
Literally. You cannot pause a quantum computer halfway through and check the variables like you can with C++ code. The act of observation ruins the whole calculation.
So if I'm the opposing counsel and I demand, show me the state of the system at step 50, I'm asking for the impossible.
You're asking them to break the machine. So you have to change what you ask for in discovery. You stop asking for the state and start asking for the peripherals.
What's on that shopping list?
Calibration logs. Prove the machine was healthy that morning. Shot distributions. Show me the raw bell curve, not just the final number. And error mitigation steps. Show me how you filtered out the noise.
It's like, if I can't taste the soup while it's cooking, I want to see the grocery receipt and the temperature of the stove.
That's a perfect analogy. You verify the ingredients and the environment because you can't touch the product until it's done.
Now, there is a specific trap mentioned in the discovery section that scared the life out of me. The deemed export risk.
Oh, it's a massive compliance minefield. Quantum computing is considered a critical national security technology. It is heavily regulated under U.S. export laws.
So what's the scenario? How does this happen?
Let's say you are in a discovery dispute. You demand access to the source code. The judge grants it. You bring in your technical expert to review the files.
Standard procedure.
But your expert is a foreign national, maybe a brilliant physicist from a university in Europe or Asia. The moment you show them that code, even if they are standing in a secure room in Chicago.
It's an export, just by them looking at the screen.
Yes. It is a deemed export to their home country. And if you don't have a specific license for that, you have just facilitated a federal crime.
Wow. So the discovery request itself isn't just a tactical decision, it's a national security compliance check.
It completely changes how you hire expert witnesses. You have to check passports before you check PhDs.
Let's pull this all together. We've got the theory, fidelity, the ladder, the discovery traps. The course provides a case study that shows how this plays out. Volkoff Materials v. Aerogen Dynamics.
This is a hypothetical, but it's written to mirror exactly what we expect to see in patent law in the next few years.
Set the scene for us.
Volkoff Materials has a patent on a battery compound. Aerogen releases a new, better battery. Volkoff sues, claiming Aerogen must have copied their work because the chemistry is too similar.
A standard patent troll move. You stole our idea.
Right. But Aerogen's defense is, we didn't steal it. We discovered a new molecule using a quantum simulation. They introduce Exhibit Q, the simulation results, but they make a dangerous admission.
Which is?
They say, we cannot run this simulation again and get the exact same numbers, and no classical computer is powerful enough to check our work.
They admit the lack of identity. So Volkoff's lawyers go for the throat. They launch a Daybert challenge, the hearing to exclude junk science.
This is the showdown, identity versus fidelity. Aerogen argues, look at the calibration logs. Look at the echo verification. The process is reliable, even if the output vibrates.
And the judge's ruling.
The judge admits the evidence. And this is the precedent we need to watch for. The judge rules that admissibility is satisfied by fidelity. The fact that the numbers wobble goes to the weight of the evidence.
Meaning, let the jury decide.
Exactly. It goes to the jury. And this is the most fascinating part for me. We are asking a jury of laypeople to look at a probability curve and decide if it constitutes truth.
We're forcing the jury to become statistical thinkers. They aren't hearing, he did it. They're hearing there is a 94% probability distribution that this molecule behaves this way.
Ideally, yes. But practically, it boils down to credibility. Which expert can explain the why? Which side looks like they're hiding behind the black box, and which side is opening up the calibration logs for everyone to see?
So for the listener, whether you're a lawyer, a tech lead, or just trying to navigate this new world, what is the big shift here?
We're moving from a world of deterministic truth, where the answer is yes or no, to a world of probabilistic truth.
And if you are making decisions based on data, you have to stop looking for the single right answer.
You have to look for the reliability of the process. You have to verify the verification.
This is why I think the full quantum law course is actually necessary. We're hitting the high notes, but the course materials, the checklists for discovery, the specific questions for cross-examination, those are tools you can't really improvise.
No, you need the manual. The reliability ladder alone is something every litigator should have pinned to their wall.
And there is a bonus mentioned for those who finish the course, a fireside chat with the creator, Ralph Luzzi.
Yes. This seems to be the reward for getting through the hard physics.
The materials describe it as a safe, confidential space to ask the wild questions, the stuff that would get you laughed out of a courtroom.
We're talking about class 5 topics here, the multiverse.
This is my favorite part of the theory, the idea that quantum computers are so powerful because they might be outsourcing the calculation.
It's a theory called many worlds. When the quantum computer is in superposition, when the water is in all the paths at once, some physicists, like David Deutsch, argue that the calculation is actually being performed across parallel realities.
That creates a pretty wild legal question. If my computer uses resources from a parallel universe to solve a problem, do I own the copyright? Or does the version of me in the other universe own it?
That is definitely a question for the fireside chat with Ralph, not for the judge. But it shows how deep this rabbit hole goes. We start with evidence rules and end up debating the nature of reality.
It connects the practical to the profound. You come for the federal rules of evidence, you stay for the existential crisis.
Better to have a crisis in a confidential fireside chat than during opening statements.
True. Before we sign off, I want to leave a listener with one final image. We've talked about the machine as a witness, we've talked about the jury weighing probabilities, but there's a deeper connection here.
Think about the role of the observer in quantum mechanics. The wave function, that water in the maze, doesn't become a reality until it is measured, until it is observed.
And in a trial.
In a trial, you have all these competing narratives, conflicting testimony, probabilities of guilt or liability. It's all just swirling in superposition.
Until the verdict.
The lawyer's job, and ultimately the jury's job, is to be the observer. You look at the distribution of facts and you make a decision. You force the probability to collapse into a single result. Guilty or not guilty. Liable or not liable.
So a verdict isn't just finding out what happened, it's actively creating the reality of the case.
In a probabilistic universe, judgment is the ultimate act of collapsing the wave function.
That is a heavy responsibility to place on a jury. But maybe that's what justice is, collapsing the chaos into order.
I think that's exactly what it is.
We'll let you collapse your own thoughts on that. This has been the deep dive into the quantum witness. If you want to be ready when the water starts flooding the courtroom, check out the full course.
See you next time.
Thanks.